You are listening to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton. Hello and welcome to another episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, here on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton, 34-year police veteran, author of A Cop's Life, and the founder of The Wounded Blue, the national assistance and support organization for injured and disabled law enforcement officers. Welcome to this week's episode. We got great guest for you. I am so fortunate to be able to interview such amazing people for this show. I got to tell you, it's a blast for me. But before we go into the interview room, let's take a walk into the briefing room, where I'm going to give you my view from the blue. Politics and policing, politics and policing. They seem to go hand in hand, even though they should not actually be concerned with one another. But unfortunately, the reality is quite different. Politics and policing. Well, there was a very high-profile event this week in Chicago. The International Association of Chiefs of Police had their annual convention. And this is where all of the chiefs and administrative leaders of police organizations from all over the country gather to talk about the issues and have camaraderie and have great speakers, and you know, it's a pretty cool event. Well, leave it to a police chief to screw it up. The President of the United States, Donald Trump, who arguably has done more for law enforcement in his term than I think any president in recent memory. The man has shown nothing but respect, admiration for the American law enforcement officer. He's done everything he could to make the lives of cops better. He's keynote speaker, as you might well imagine. Well, the chief, or the superintendent of the Chicago Police Department, even though it's this IECP convention is being held in his city, well, he decided to play politics and come out with a very, very political statement that he was going to boycott the event because they invited President Donald Trump to speak. I mean, it's mind-boggling. Mind-boggling how the leader of a police organization who should be apolitical, would use this grandstanding moment to perpetuate his particular political motivations. It's outrageous. And I'm not the only one that felt that way. The entire police union felt the same way. In fact, the police union leaders came out and said exactly what I said, that this is not a time for politics. This is a time to show respect. And if you don't like it, if you don't like the guy, then just sit there and listen and nod politely and adios. But to come out and publicly insult the President of the United States as the head of the police was an affront to all of the men and women who serve in Chicago. So the police union really let their displeasure be known when they did a vote of no confidence in their superintendent. I would say that's a pretty bold statement by the Chicago Police Union. Now, here's where this is almost kind of amusing. This comes only a week after Superintendent Eddie Johnson, who's the superintendent we're talking about here, was forced to publicly open an internal affairs investigation into himself. Yep, you heard me right. He had to publicly come out and say that he was asking internal affairs to investigate him. Now, this happened after he was found sleeping in his car at about 1:30 in the morning, and somebody called 911. They reported a body in a car, and turned out it's the superintendent sleeping. And at first he said, oh, no alcohol involved. I had a change in my medication. I pulled over and fell asleep. Well, turns out that he was lying. Yep, he's lying. Superintendent lied. I know that's a shock. Yeah, he was drinking. And somebody at the restaurant reported him that he was drinking. And then he said, oh, yeah, I may have had one drink with dinner or something like that. So meanwhile, now there's an internal affairs investigation. Here's the problem. I'm going to bet you that the responding officers who found him and let him drive home, they're the ones that are going to get in trouble, not the superintendent. Superintendent's pretty much bulletproof up there in Chicago, if you will. And if anybody, you've heard of something rolling downhill, well, mark my words, I'll bet you that's what happens here. So once again, another police leader allows politics to rule his day and couldn't care less about the oath that he took. Instead of protecting and serving, he makes a political statement. You know, it seems that, politics, even if they're not party politics, is ruling the roost when it comes down to decision making. An incident happened in Oregon. I know we're going to go from Chicago to Oregon. Worlds apart, but then again. So here's what happened. Well, here's the headline, and then I'll tell you what happened. Oregon State Police to pull out of Oregon State University after being attacked over arrest. Quote, you're on your own now, unquote. I love it. So here's what happened. For 30 years, the Oregon State Police has been the police agency of the Oregon State University. Generally speaking, these universities employ their own police officers. But in this particular case, there's been a good enough relationship. The Oregon State Police took on those duties. Well, that is ended after one of their state police officers made a stop on a bicyclist who was committed an infraction, a university student. And when the officer explained, and this is all on body cam, of course, explained to her that he needed to see her identification for the infraction, she told him that she's not giving him anything and that she doesn't have to talk to him because he is an oppressor of her people. White cop, black operator of the bicycle, black female. And he explained for time after time after time what her responsibilities were, why he stopped her. He was exceedingly patient with her. And eventually she said, I don't have to answer your questions. You're the oppressor. He said, look, he says, you have to by law. He says, I just wanted to give you a warning, but I'm going to give you a citation. I need to see your identification. And she just said no. So he called for a backup. Smart thing to do. There was already a crowd gathering. And then he told her one more time. He says, if you don't give me your identification, I'm going to arrest you. And once again, she refused. And so guess what? He went to arrest her, and she decided to resist arrest. Now, she didn't punch him or kick him or anything like that. She did what's called active resisting. That means she just wouldn't allow them to handcuff her, and she pulled away, and she, hit her arms and such like that. And meanwhile, she's screaming for help and creating, of course, another, public scene so people could videotape it and then blame the cops. And that's exactly what happened. So the officers got her into custody. They gave her a citation, whatever they gave her, arrested her, and then she got out on her own recognizance. And what happens? A firestorm of controversy. How dare this police officer put his hands on this poor, innocent woman? All she was doing was riding her bicycle. And the university, instead of backing up their officer for doing exactly what he should have been doing, they come out, and of course, they blamed him. Talking about the racist officer, et cetera, and so forth. Well, guess what? The Oregon State Police said, if you're going to treat us like that, you're on your own. And I, for one, am happy to see that a police agency made a decision that actually showed some guts and said, you know what, if you're going to treat us like this, then we're not, you go police yourselves. See how that works out for you. So I think that's very interesting. Poor cop, of course, he's the one vilified. And this racism, this ridiculous narrative of institutional racism in policing has gotten to the point where it's absolutely incredible. Listen to this one. Sometimes I read a headline, I look at the story, and I just sit there and shake my head. Investigation launched after, quote, racist, unquote, stuffed animal seen in police vehicle. Yeah, you heard me right. Now a stuffed animal is racist. I don't even know how to explain that. This is in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. A stuffed monkey seen in the back of a Winston-Salem police car prompted an internal affairs investigation after citizens complained that the children's toy was racist. So this woman sees, she was walking by this car, she sees this stuffed animal in there, starts creating a video and said that it was the most racist thing she's ever seen. Okay, she says, this is the police, the woman says into the video. Do y'all see this? In the back of the car, the whole live got a monkey right there. That's crazy. She then posted the video and said that the act made her question the officer's intent towards black men in the community. Oh, you got to be kidding me. So this prompted a big investigation. They had to spend time and money and resources. Well, it turns out that they have a lot of stuffed toys in the police cars to give to children when they're on calls because it calms the children down. And so they get these toys donated to them, and then they put them in the police cars so they can give them to children. And now that was apparently deemed racist by this moron who reported it. And the police chief wound up apologizing. At least the police chief said, listen, this is what they're here for. They're donated to us, but we'll be a lot more careful about the stuffed toys we put in our police car so we don't offend anyone. God help us if we offend anyone. It's gotten to the point where this nonsense just continues to bubble over like some weird stew of hate. In fact, it got even more crazy. Philadelphia police ban tattoos liberals find offensive. Yeah, okay, so there was a protest, and one of the officers had a tattoo that was in actuality the symbol of the German police force, and it wasn't Nazi. It is the present German police logo, and this complainant, who of course was one of the people protesting the police there, makes this internal affairs complaint, and the city then creates this insane policy that if somebody gets offended by your tattoo, you can't wear your tattoo, you have to cover it up, or they won't hire you. I mean, it's just, it has gotten to the point where it doesn't matter what the police do. Some idiot is going to be offended by something. And then instead of these administrators having the guts to stand up and say, you know what, you're out of line here, go away. They cave in and they acquiesce to these ridiculous charges and these ridiculous points of view. It's gotten to the point where it's making jobs so much more difficult for officers. And we wonder why we can't keep cops and we can't hire cops. because 66% drop in recruitment, and it's because of incidents like this. And also in New York, just the other day, two officers are making an arrest. Somebody calls about a guy acting crazy and attacking people in a nail salon. They go to make an arrest. They're going to wrestling with the guy. And a guy comes in off the street and starts beating the cop in the head with a metal chair, putting him in a coma. And the other officer opens fire and kills him. And now they're blaming the cops. They're blaming the cops. This guy's in a coma. And they're not even allowed to defend themselves in the media here, because they're being called, you know, excessive force. It's the police. It's not the guy who came in off the street and attacked him. This is the type of incident which is destroying the fabric of the law enforcement system here in the United States. I could go on and on, but we got to go see our guest in the interview room. I've got an announcement to make. It's about a new company, and it's a company that is near and dear to my heart because I'm part of it. And not only am I part of it, but this company was created to help injured and disabled law enforcement officers. This company is called Law Dog Coffee Company. That's right. Law Dog Coffee Company. Tastes so good, it ought to be illegal. Oh, yeah. Now, I got to tell you, I love coffee. I've been drinking it since I was a wee lad. And there's nothing better than sitting in a cold patrol car with a hot cup of coffee. And we have done a deal with the Costa Rican government to bring in some of the finest ethically grown coffee that is available anywhere. It is delicious. And you got to get yourself a bag of it. Go to lawdogcoffeecompany.com. That's lawdogcoffeecompany.com. Get yourself a couple bags of fantastic premium coffee. And then get to me on Facebook and tell me what you think about it. Law Dog Coffee Company. Tastes so good. Ought to be illegal.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world. To unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications. America Out Loud Talk Radio.
We have a great guest with us here in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio. She is doing amazing work. Gloria Gilbert is the founder and the CEO of Puppies Behind Bars, an organization that is doing some amazing work training police service dogs and explosives, sniffing dogs, for law enforcement officers all over this country. And you know who's doing it? Prisoners in prison. And they are working together to make our country a little bit safer. Gloria Gilbert, thanks so much for being here. And Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Thanks for inviting me, Randy.
So, you know, I heard about your organization through some mutual acquaintances in that are in the law enforcement industry, and they introduced us because of what we do is at the Wounded Blue, the national support and assistance organization for injured and disabled law enforcement officers, which I founded. And then with what you do with training service dogs. So it's like a perfect introduction. And when I heard about what you're doing, I really wanted to bring you on to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, and let people know that you exist and what your organization does.
Well, thanks very much, because we're trying to get the word out, so really appreciate this opportunity.
So first of all, let's talk about when the organization was created and the reason behind it.
Okay. So I started it 22 years ago in 1997. We started by having prison inmates raise guide dogs for the blind. The premise was always that while they're incarcerated and while taxpayers are paying 100% of housing, food, medical, et cetera, that inmates could be given an opportunity to contribute to society, that they don't get anything out of it, but they're giving back for having wronged society. So that's always been the premise, and that has never changed. What changed was that after I started in 97, as I said, September 11th happened. So after September 11th, and I'm here in New York City and just saw the devastation to my city and saw how law enforcement just kept us safe and kept us emotionally sane. We decided that we would start raising explosive detection canines as a way of saying thank you. And as you and your listeners know, the need for explosive detection canines in this country and abroad just skyrocketed after September 11th. So we started that in early 2002. And we're fine doing explosive detection canines and guide dogs until 2006, when every single day I'd open the newspaper and see pictures of Americans getting blown up in Iraq and Afghanistan. I kept thinking, I'm sitting here in my comfortable apartment in New York while my fellow men and women are fighting for our country. What can I do to help them? And it dawned on me, I can do dogs. That's the one thing that, you know, I had been doing. So we stopped raising guide dogs and we started raising service dogs exclusively for OIF, OEF veterans. We ended up specializing in vets with post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury. And we're doing that and still are doing that. So we're still doing EDCs, the explosive detection canines, and service dogs for wounded veterans. But in 2011 was the shooting at Sandy Hook. And that's when I really started thinking about what's it like for a first responder to walk into a scene of horrible carnage. That man or woman can't possibly be the same for the rest of their lives. And I vowed to just try and do something to help law enforcement that helps us every single day of the year, and try to get different law enforcement agencies interested in getting service dogs from us, and really was not successful, but kept plugging away. And finally, we paired our first service dogs with retired police officers in 2007. So we kind of had a breakthrough 2 years ago. And at this point, that's what we're doing. We're providing service dogs free of charge to first responders, primarily police officers and firefighters, and to veterans. And we're providing explosive detection canines to law enforcement.
You know, I love your mission. Not only do I love it, but I am so impressed with the fact that, I mean, you've been keeping this thing going for more than 22 years. That is, that's an astounding record, really.
Well, there are times I thought about quitting, believe me, but I didn't. I love what I do. And I just love, since we've been working with first responders, I love, you know, I don't have any police officers or firefighters in my family. I don't come from, I just know cops from seeing them on the street. And I just love that I'm friends with police officers. I'm friends with firefighters, and I love it. I love how it's opened my horizons. And it's been great.
I would imagine that it has been an incredibly eye-opening experience, coming from a world, as you said, where you weren't exposed to law enforcement. What is one of the takeaways that that you have had since coming to know, probably on a very close basis, a number of people who have served in law enforcement capacity and were injured, emotionally injured on the job?
I think the biggest takeaway is how hard it's been for them to ask for help. You're talking about people whose whole careers have been to help others. And what I've found is that they may be living lives of a lot of inner turmoil, but for them to say, okay, I've served and now I really need help, has been really difficult. And I've also found just really what great guys they are. And women, because we've had a female police officer who got one of our dogs for her police department. Just really, really nice, down to earth people. So I guess that sounds kind of silly because, of course, they are people, but I just...
No,
you know,
doesn't sound silly at all. Not at all.
Okay. So those are the eye openers that for them to say, I now need help from my community, how difficult it is, and for them to just be as totally open. And as you said, all of our dogs are raised in prison. So I think that was one of the initial obstacles that law enforcement said, wait a second, you got to be kidding. You think that we're going to get service dogs raised in prison? And the police officers with whom I've worked have just been so gracious. They've just said, you know what, I'm going to give it a try. I'm a little skeptical. I'm nervous because half of our training takes place in prison. So it's not just that the dogs are raised in prison, but we train the law enforcement agents who get our dogs for 14 days. And for 8 of those days, we go into prison. So, you know, the law enforcement that have gone into prison have been skeptical, scared, dubious, whatever. And they, literally within the first day, they realize that the inmates are remorseful, that they're really trying to do something right, and that they're really proud of being able to work directly with police officers.
I'm going to revisit that because this is a really fascinating part of what you do. There's so much more to this story than simply adopting out dogs to, you know, training and adopting them out to needy people. So I want to travel back in time just a moment. Tell me a little bit about your personal history and before you got into this.
I've been in the nonprofit world forever. I started my career in New York with the Carnegie Council. I ran a program on privatization because that was kind of, this was in the in the 80s. Then I went to UNICEF and I was the head of UNICEF for New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And from there, I went to City Hall and I worked for Mayor Giuliani during his first term. And it was then that I realized what I really wanted to do was something different. And I read an article in People magazine about a veterinarian in Florida who came up with the first prison guide dog program in the country. And I read it and I just thought, that is brilliant. And so it was his inspiration that really just got me going. And I gave notice to the mayor's office and contacted the Department of Corrections in New York State and said, you know, I want to put dogs in your prisons.
How was that received? I mean, because that's a pretty radical idea.
It was really a radical idea. I was extremely fortunate. Libby Pataki, who was the First Lady of New York at that time, because George Pataki was our governor, I knew her through the work I had done at the Carnegie Council. And when I wanted to put dogs in prison, I knew no one in corrections. I knew nothing about corrections. The only person I knew was Libby. And as, you know, First Lady of New York, she was obviously really busy, but I wrote her a letter and I said, Libby, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to train prison inmates to raise guide dogs. And she got it. She got it immediately that it was about rehabilitation, it was about education, and it was about second chances. So without her help, Puppy Span Bars never would have gotten started. But with her help, the Department of Corrections for New York State said, give it a shot.
Incredible. I mean, it's a beautiful story. So how many people help you? I mean, this is
We're small. We've got 10 full-time staff and 4 part-time staff. Part-time meaning like really part-time in some cases, one day a week. And then the inmates, the dogs are all Labrador retrievers. They enter prison when they're 8 weeks of age. If they're going to be explosive detection canines, they stay with us for a year. And if they're going to be service dogs, the training is longer and they stay with us anywhere from 2 to 3 years. So we've got 150, 175 inmates in our program. So they're doing the bulk of the work. They're doing virtually all the training of the dogs. And then we've got something like 300 volunteers. So we've got all these people who just from the goodness of their hearts, you know, on a voluntary basis, help us by taking the dogs out of prison so the dogs can get exposed to what I call the real world.
Yeah, that's an interesting I didn't think about that. So the dogs are raised for 2 to 3 years in the prison environment, and then they are called upon to enter the real world and provide these services to their partners.
Exactly. So what we do is from the time literally they're 10 weeks of age, they go out of prison once or twice a week with volunteers. So they learn how to ride in cars. They're exposed to kids. They go to schools. They go to soccer games. They go to dentist offices. They go to churches. They go to synagogues. Every weekend, we bring 2 vanfuls of puppies into New York City. So all of our dogs are used to the chaos of a city. So it's our volunteers. Without our volunteers, I keep saying our dogs would be incredibly well loved, incredibly well trained, and none of them would be able to work because they would freak out as soon as a skateboard went by or as soon as a jackhammer, you know, started going off behind them. So our volunteers really are the ones who round out our puppies.
So this is even more of a complication in training than I was thinking. You've got the training itself by the inmates, but then you have to basically acclimate these animals to the social environment and to getting along with people. That's a monstrous task. So how many dogs do you have being trained at a time?
We have approximately 75 to 80, but since we started 22 years ago, we've raised over 1,200 dogs. So at this point, we really know Labrador retrievers.
I'll bet you do. So I know we were talking about, you know, one of the reasons I wanted you on the show was to help law enforcement officers and the community know about what you're doing, because I had never heard of your organization, and I've been in the law enforcement industry for a long time. So we wanted to get that word out. And I understand that just today you had a major win about awareness.
Yeah, the Today Show did a really nice piece on us. It's on their website. I think it's called Women Inmates Find Love Behind Bars or something like that. But a first for us was that, and I mentioned this briefly earlier, we in August, so just 2 months ago, paired our first service dog with a police officer, not as her own dog. She does not have post-traumatic stress, but as a an officer wellness dog for her police department in Groton, Connecticut. So her dog goes with her to work every day. If there's something that a police officer has seen or done, some kind of critical incident, the dog is there. If the police officer just wants to pet the dog or talk to the dog. And then whenever she goes into the community, the dog goes with her, the idea being that she will be more approachable if she's got this friendly, gorgeous black Labrador retriever by her side. So the Today Show did a piece on that, on the first active duty police officer and police department that has gotten a service dog from us. And it's just, it's really, really cool. And that's something new, and we would love to do more of that. If there aren't law enforcement agents who themselves need dogs, but if their chief or whomever understands the power of dogs to be able to heal, we would love to donate dogs to police departments just for the wellness of everyone at the department.
Well, I'm sure that there's some notes being taken right now.
I hope so.
So from a practical standpoint, I'm the chief of police of a town. I contact you and I say, I want to get a service dog for my department. What are the steps that have to take place?
There's an application which is on our website, and the website's puppiesbehindbars.com. It's a pretty intensive application. Fill that in, return it to us. We need to know that, A, the dog can go to the station house every single day, or the station every single day, that everybody up the chain of command agrees with this. You then have to show us that you're able to really take care of a dog and incorporate a dog into your day. If both of those criteria are met, then we would accept you and we would fly you, if you're outside of driving area, we'd fly you into upstate New York for 14 days. We will train you on everything about our dogs know 92 commands. So we will train you in those 92 commands. We'll teach you how to, you know, be in public with the dog, how to go to the movies with the dog, et cetera, et cetera. And then you'll go home with the dog. Puppy Sand Bars pays 100% of the expenses. And we estimate that our dogs, by the time our dogs go home with somebody, that they're worth $40,000. But we pay all the expenses because it's just really our way of saying thank you for what you guys do for us on a daily basis.
You know, that was that figure that you just spoke about, $40,000. I've been doing some research on service dogs because of the community that we serve, our injured and disabled law enforcement. And I was shocked that the costs are that high. But yeah. I know from doing my research, but these dogs are exceedingly highly trained.
Exactly.
This isn't going down to the puppy mill and grabbing yourself a cute dog. This is real intensive work that the inmates are doing. Let's talk about the inmates for a minute.
Okay.
I've got to imagine that when you started this program, were you met with incredulousness by the prisoners that they were going to have this opportunity?
Yes. We started in a women's maximum security prison, New York's only maximum security prison for women, and we're still there. We were met with incredulousness. We were met with, wow, somebody really is going to trust me with a life. I mean, I think that's also what this boils down to, that, you know, these puppies are live beings. And as I said, they go into prison when they're 8 weeks of age and they live there. They live in the cells. They're locked in at night with the inmates. So we trust that somebody is going to take care of this dog and love and nurture and train this dog. So we were met with incredulity, but there's another thing about Puppy Sand Bars, which is we are really, really tough. It's a completely voluntary program for the inmates, so they can quit whenever they want, or we can kick them out whenever they want. And if they don't do the homework, if they don't do well on their tests and quizzes, if we think they're lazy, we will kick them out. So I think we were met with incredulity at how tough we were, that, you know, we weren't going to take any lip. It's like, okay, we're offering you a great opportunity. If you're smart enough to take advantage of it, good for you. And if you're not, you know, see you later.
Right. How are the inmates trained to do this work? I mean, I imagine this is pretty specialized work here.
It is. We have professional staff that go into each of our prisons one full day a week. I teach in a prison every Friday, for example. So one day a week, we're there for 5.5 hours. We're training the inmates. We're seeing how the dogs are doing. And when the dogs leave prison and go out with our volunteers, the volunteers write feedback letters. So they'll say, you know, ran into, you know, motorcycles and the dog got totally, completely scared, or ran into a group of kids and the dog was perfect with the kids. So together we get a full picture of the dog, and based on what the volunteers tell us, what they've seen on the outside, we then try to work on those issues, those problems on the inside.
So that brings up another topic for me. So these inmates are given this training. Is there any certification involved with this? That, you know, once they have gone through all this training and have done this, they become certified as a service dog trainer?
Yeah, after they've been in the program for 18 months, they can get a certificate which says that the Department of Labor has job titles, and they qualify for the job title of animal caretaker. And after they've been in the program for 2 years, it's completely voluntary, but if they want to, they can take what I call a comprehensive exam. It's a 3-hour exam. It's written as well as hands-on. If they pass that, then they get a certificate which says that they are a dog trainer. There's no such thing as a certified service dog trainer. It's a totally unregulated industry. So we can say they're dog trainers, but there's no such thing as a certified service dog trainer.
Gotcha.
And a number of the inmates go, when they get out, they go on to work in animal-related fields. So they really
That was going to be my next question. I would imagine that once they've been basically in this field, sometimes for years, it gives them a life skill that really is important on the outside.
Yes. You know, it gives them a lot of life skills that are important on the outside. And if you asked me to name what I thought was the most important, I would say that they learn not to give up when things get really tough. Raising a puppy into a full-fledged working dog that knows 92 commands and is good enough to wear a puppy's handlebars jacket, there's a lot of highs and lows. And virtually all the inmates will tell you that heretofore in their life, when things got tough, they gave up. They just walked away. And I think the most important thing is that they learn to stick with it. And I really feel like that's going to help them when they're back on the street, that, you know what? If you do get a real job and, you know, you have a crappy day in the office, which all of us do, instead of just saying, I'm out of here and I'm not showing up tomorrow, you pause and you say, okay, I know I can do it because I raised the puppy through, you know, X, Y, or Z. So I think teaching them responsibility is about the biggest thing that Puppies Behind Bars teaches.
Have you seen let's get back into what happens when you've chosen a candidate that's going to get a dog. And it can be either the explosive dog or the service dog. You will then provide transportation for that individual to fly to, where is it, New York?
Yeah, it's upstate New York. It's 45 minutes north of New York City.
Okay, so they can fly into upstate New York. You put them up, you bring them for 2 weeks into the prison system, into the prison for, mm-hmm. And they have interaction with the inmate who trained the dog.
Yep.
That's got to be a wild thing to see.
It is. It is. It really is. The Today Show piece showed part of that about this police officer, Heather McClellan, getting her dog and training with the inmate who raised her dog. So it gives you a nice, a little hit of what goes on, you know, behind bars. But yeah, it's pretty amazing to see.
I keep on thinking about the prisoner aspect for some reason. I don't know why, but after having this dog for 2 to 3 years, there's got to be some postpartum depression that takes place here.
You know, they're really sad. Male inmates cry, female inmates cry. They cry in front of corrections officers. But the overriding feeling is pride. They feel successful in themselves because they produced a successful dog. And that's, you know, they don't, in prison, most things are me, 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 me. I'm going to keep my head down. I'm going to do whatever the corrections officer says. I'm not going to get in trouble. I'm going to go to meal on time. I'm going to make my bed, whatever. It's me, 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 me. I'm going to shower. I'm going to... With a dog, it's doggy comes first, I come second for the whole time they have the dog. And so they learn to put something ahead of themselves. And then when it's time to pass that dog off to a police officer, they feel a sense of selflessness, which they probably never felt before. But they genuinely have done something very good for a total stranger, and they feel so proud of themselves.
That's fascinating. That really is. Is there ever any connection later on between the inmate and the officer whose dog they gave? Is there any communication that says, hey, you want to thank you for what you did for this dog, or any continuing relationship?
Yeah, the recipient of the dog, the police officer, can write letters to the office. Everything has to be through the office. It can just be, you know, this is the dog changed my life. This is how the doggy and I are doing. It could be pictures of the dog, not of people, but just of the dog. And we'll print that and we'll bring it into prison. Not infrequently, people choose to come back to prison. And it's all arranged in advance, but they come in during one of our classes and they just thank the inmates in person for changing their lives. So, it's a minority who do that, but man, you know, if somebody chooses to come back to prison after a year or 2 years of living with the dog or 3 or 4 years and thanking the inmates, it has a real big impact.
That's, I find that really powerful. So, the retired police officers now, you're opening this up to active duty and retired law enforcement, correct?
Yes, yes.
How would an officer apply for a service dog?
On our website, there's an application. It's called Apply for a Service Dog for First Responders. So that would be an officer's application. Fill it out. If there's any questions, they can contact me or Nora Moran, whose name's on the application. And that's pretty straightforward. If they wanted a dog for their police department, they should call me. We can talk it through, and then they would have to get the necessary approvals up the chain of command. But once they got that, then it's the same process. We would bring them in, and they would be in a class of a maximum of 6 people. Retired cops, active duty cops, firefighters, veterans, we mix them all together. And for 14 days, we would train them. And then they go home with their dog. We do a follow-up visit 4 months after they've gone home with their dog. And then once a year, we come out to certify them. They need to pass a test that they're still an active working team, and both dog and person are still safe in public.
Gotcha. So what is the criteria for, does someone have to have a doctor's certificate saying that they are suffering from post-traumatic stress?
Yes. If that's what they want the dog for, yes. If it's an active duty officer for a police department, then obviously that doesn't apply. But if it's somebody with PTSD who wants a dog for themselves, they have to have a medical professional say that, yes, this person does have PTSD. And yes, this person could take care of a service dog.
I see. Okay. Well, we're running low on time, but this has been, to me, just a fascinating, fascinating interview. What you're doing is changing lives, probably saving lives as well. And at the same time, it's forming a unique opportunity for inmates who are, you know, they're forgotten people, mm-hmm. to improve their lives, to improve probably a relationship that they never thought they would have.
Yeah.
And change. You're changing, you know, a life by life opportunity here. People bringing them together in just amazing ways. So, how can people help you?
Go to our website. How they can help the most is spread the word. If you're in law enforcement or you're not, but you know somebody in law enforcement, just say that there are service dogs out here free of charge for law enforcement or police departments or fire departments that may want a dog just for multiple people, not just for one. So the biggest thing is spreading the word. That would be the biggest help people could offer us.
I would imagine that you also take donations.
We do take donations. I mean, I appreciate that. We're completely privately funded, so we don't get government funding by design. So I appreciate that very much. But at this point, you know, yes, I'm never going to turn down a check. I can promise you that. But, you know, at this point, just helping police officers know that service dogs are there for them, that's something I can't do because I just have limited reach. So
right.
That would be a huge help.
Well, I can tell you this, that as the founder of the Wounded Blue, the National Assistance and Support Organization, we will support your endeavor and we will will help get the word out.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for this opportunity. It's been really, really nice speaking with you.
No, the pleasure has been mine. Thanks for being a voice here on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Thanks, Randy.
There's something very important I want you to do for me. If you've been listening to the Voice of American Law Enforcement for any time, you know that we are very dedicated to the law enforcement community here. I would like you to go to a website. It's www.thewoundedblue.org. I want you to read about how we at this organization are aiding injured and disabled law enforcement officers. If you are a law enforcement officer, and you have been injured or disabled, and you feel forgotten and alone, this is why we exist. We have a fully trained peer support team, all made of police officers who have been shot, stabbed, beaten, run over, screwed up, and screwed up. They know what you're going through, and we exist for you. You are the part of the Blue family, and you deserve to be treated with respect and dignity. Unfortunately, many police agencies and cities do not treat their officers with respect and dignity when they are injured, either physically or emotionally. So go to thewoundedblue.org. If you are a citizen and you want to help, please check out how you can join the Wounded Blue. And if you're a police officer or have been, exist for you. So check out thewoundedblue.org. Now, I would also urge you to see our film. It is on Amazon, it is on iTunes, it's the Microsoft Store, it's pretty much every platform you can imagine. It's called The Wounded Blue, Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. You would be shocked at how the men and women of this, you know, the law enforcement community in this country, many are being treated with such disrespect. Many people, most people, even cops, believe that if you are severely injured in the line of duty, you're going to be taken care of financially and emotionally. In many cases, that is not true. Please watch the film and help the Wounded Blue.
End of Watch with Randy Sutton.
Each week, we here at Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, pay our respects to the men and women of the profession who have made the ultimate sacrifice and given their lives in the line of duty.
This week, I have one name to read. The officer who lost his life is Deputy Sheriff Brian Ishmael of the El Dorado County Sheriff's Office in California. Deputy Sheriff Brian Ishmael was shot and killed while responding to a call reporting a larceny of marijuana plants in the area of Sand Ridge Road and Mount Aucum Road in the rural Somerset community. A subject operating a marijuana grow had observed several men stealing plants at approximately 12:30 a.m. and stated that a vehicle was parked at a neighbor's home. Deputy Ishmael and an off-duty deputy from the San Joaquin County Sheriff's Office, who was riding along with him, responded to the area. Shortly after 1 a.m., he broadcasted that shots had been fired. Deputy Ishmael and the off-duty deputy both exchanged shots with multiple subjects. Deputy Ishmael was shot and killed, and the off-duty deputy was wounded during the shootout. Two men, one of whom was wounded, were taken into custody by responding officers. The 9/11 caller was also arrested after it was discovered he was a business partner of the shooters and failed to disclose the relationship to police. Deputy Ishmael served with the El Dorado County Sheriff's Office for 4 years, had previously served with the Placerville Police. He is survived by his wife. Deputy Sheriff Brian Ishmael, El Dorado County Sheriff's Office, California. End of watch, Wednesday, October 23rd, 2019. May he rest in peace. Thanks for tuning in this week to another episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, here on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. I would ask that you join me on Facebook at the voice of American law enforcement. If you're a Twitter, I'm at LT Randy Sutton. And always support wounded and disabled police officers by going to thewoundedblue.org. That's thewoundedblue.org. And do what you can to help these men and women who have sacrificed so much for their communities.